Enterprise with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 105th episode of Robots. I am Jana, and today we have contributions from Marja Kruzma and Diana Sava, and we'll hear about robot fish and a revolution in online clothes shopping. But first, let's take a look at the news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. With the annual International Conference for Robotics and Automation, or ICRA, the first ROS conference, ROSCON, and Germany's largest biannual trade fair for automation and mechatronics, the Automatica in Munich, all in the past 2 weeks, we have lots of news to report. Researchers from MIT have demonstrated an autonomous model airplane that can fly through GPS-denied environments. A video shows a small plane flying high-speed turns in a parking garage. The plane relies on a pre-existing 3D occupancy map and uses a planar laser rangefinder, an IMU, and a beefy 1.6 GHz Atom onboard processor for localization. Researchers at Chiba University in Japan have taught a robot to juggle two balls in one hand. The robot uses high-speed vision system to track the balls and calculates catching and throwing trajectories in real time. In more news, version 2 of the popular TurtleBot developed by Willow Garage has been officially announced. An iKlebo Kabuki base from Korean firm Eugene Robot now replaces the iRobot Create base. And finally, Boston Dynamics has released videos of their Cheetah robot walking and trotting on a treadmill. As always, you can find videos of these and more news on the robot's website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Professor Marja Kruzma is the head of TUT's Center for Biorobotics in Estonia, and she's involved in the PHILOS Robotic Fish Locomotion and Sensing Project, which attempts to build robots that can mimic how fish react and adapt to the water flow around them. Our reporter pair talked to Professor Kruzma to find out more about PHILOS.
You worked hard on actually making robotic fish. Can you describe a little bit what you've learned about?
Traditionally, to make fish robots is to have what roboticists normally choose are good at building. First of all, historically, they were good at building robotic manipulators. So you're a mechanical engineer. You know how to calculate a mechanical serial link chain. And of course, the first plan you come up with if you want to do something that wiggles underwater is that you make a serial link manipulator. And then you can apply all the things that you learn from school and beyond that to calculate the right angles and then the right kinematics and trajectories and work dynamics out of that. But what also happens with a serial link manipulator or serial link robot or underwater robot is the more links you have, the more complicated your mechanism becomes. And the more complicated your mechanism becomes, you probably find it hard to miniaturize it. Because motors themselves have a certain size, so you can't take them down to infinitely small structures. And although the bigger and the more complicated they become, the less reliable they become, and the more expensive they become. And this is also why underwater robotics is a rather conservative field of robotics. You just don't go play around underwater with very expensive things because you're very likely to lose them.
Yeah.
So you get really, really careful about it. And it's completely understandable if you have to send your robots under the ice shelf somewhere in Antarctic. You don't put these fancy new theories on board of your robot because you must be sure the thing is coming back to you. But at the same time, it's kind of natural the things that you have this chain structure, or you have this joint structure of the fish, because if you look at the fish, there is kind of a justification for that. Muscular structure of a fish is also a very distributed one. There are hundreds and some hundreds of muscle fibers next to each other, and fish are probably able to operate, most of them, quite independent from each other. But at the same time, we looked at biological evidence, how fish actually use their muscles. And all organs, basically, where muscles are, you can say they have two classes of muscles. They have white muscles and they have red muscles. And white muscles are those muscles that sprinters are using with a sprint, which put out a lot of force, but very short time output force. So you run 100 meters and you get awfully, awfully, awfully tired because they consume up all your oxygen. And then you have these red muscles with long, slim muscles. And these are the muscles that marathoners are mostly using. You can go on forever and forever and forever. There are evidence that people can run for days without stopping, actually, just using the red muscles and going to their resonance frequency, so to speak, consuming very little energy. And fish, most of fish also have this distribution between two kinds of muscles. You have red muscles and you have white muscles. And it turns out that white muscles take up at some species even 80% of your body, but you use them only very occasionally. So why you use them is really when you very fast accelerations or rapid turns. And why do you need to do that? Well, in cases where there is a threat that you are going to be eaten, or in cases when you want to eat somebody. So if you build a robot that doesn't have to fight for its own life, the question is that why do you need these muscles anyway? So you get it as well live with red muscles. And the red muscles constitute just maybe 10-20% of the body. And the fish that uses these muscles can go on forever with a cruising speed. It's about 1-2 body lengths per second. Just go and go and go and go. And what is even more amazing evidence is that even biologists look at the EMG signals, these are signals that actuate the muscles, the electrical signals that give orders to the muscles to contract. Then when you go on this cruising speed, you're probably using only the anterior or the first muscles of your body, those that are closer to your head, and the tail is just passive, according to the studies. So what happens is that is a beautiful example of a morphological computation. You're not using your whole body to actuate and propel yourself forward, but you're just using the properties as your body to carry the energy and convert the momentum you're creating into the water, and this propels you forward. So you can have just few actuators at some points of the body, and you can go forever and forever. You're not able to do rapid turns, and you're not able to have fast accelerations, but if this is not your mission, it really doesn't matter. So these robots we have here have only one actuator. Mm-hmm. And we've tried different kind of tails, so we played around experimentally and computationally with different materials, with different elasticity, different viscosity, to see how the signals get dampened and how the signals can convert it to water, to figure out what is the best behavior we can come up with when we're swimming in the water, so that we finally end up with a very simple, very, very simple robot, and hopefully also very cheap for these reasons.
Yeah.
And very reliable at the same time.
If it's also very cheap, we could just have 10 or 15 of them, and if they're reliable each, and then together they become super reliable, huh?
Since they become super reliable. And we can also show that if we have this fish robot that is actuated from one point only, and now we take this robot and we compare the kinematics of this robot to a kinematic of another fish of the same morphology, of the same shape of the body. For example, we're using rainbow trout here as a model fish, so we get exactly the same kinematics.
Mm. And the rainbow trout, certainly they can go for long distances.
Absolutely.
We know they live in the Pacific. Yeah. And they can also navigate some really, really turbulent waters in these streams, this really shallow water, and they can jump. I mean, we're talking meters in the air, and then continue swimming in this very, very challenging drop-off point of the waterfall. That's amazing.
Yeah. Rainbow trout is an interesting fish to model because it's a generalist. It can do everything. Fish have been adjusted to very specific niches and very specific behaviors and very specific environments. For example, a shark or a tuna fish, which is a really, really fast swimmer. It can go up to like 29 body lengths per second or something. Really, really fast purse to catch a prey. But when they try to maneuver, it's shot awful. I mean, it takes them forever to turn around and come back. And at the same time, there are fish who are really, really slow, but really good at maneuvering. You can think of an eel or a ray fish who can turn on spot or something. But rainbow trout is somewhere in the middle. And that's probably because, as you said, it has to negotiate very, very different environments, like very turbulent rivers. But at the same time, most of their lives they are bringing in the sea. And since they grow up in small ponds or small lakes or somewhere upstream, so they, during their life cycle, they see different environment and they need to negotiate all of them.
Do we also see that the morphology of them, the ratio of muscles, how they use them change when they enter the river to go upstreams? Or is there are they different fish than when they swim around in the big sea? Or are they the same fish?
No, well, say more or less the same fish. There are few fishes like sockeye salmons that develop a hump, but that's probably just for a display behavior, so for the male fish. So basic structure stays the same as far as I, non-biologist, know about it.
Which means that the same shape will actually be able to do it because we know that the fish have done it.
Yes.
We don't have to ask ourselves, is this possible? Should we pursue it? The only thing we have to ask ourselves is, can we do it? And that's a much smaller question.
Yeah, but another question which really roboticists should address more carefully is perhaps that what are the features that are really important for my task, my mission? What exactly should we mimic in this case?
Am I swimming in a river or am I swimming in a big blue ocean?
What am I doing there anyway? Mm-hmm. Makes no sense to copy a very, very complicated, say, nervous structure or a muscular structure or skeleton structure as a fish. You have no idea why does a fish need it for. Maybe it's just a very simple generalization or a very simple approximation of the same structure is already enough for your own task.
Mm-hmm. You've been doing this work for quite some time, I understand. Could you tell us a bit about the road to where you are now and then the road from there on into the future for these robotic fish?
Yeah, well, I think in my labs there is the only fish robot, the only underwater robot in the world that senses flow and can react to the flow patterns, and we can show how it does it. And there are several ways to go forward from. It's the only robot that navigates with respect to flow. And this is just very first attempts to do that. So you can think that there are very many possibilities ahead how to expand the whole topic, or you can define the new research problem, navigation with respect to the flow, or how to use hydrodynamic image in order to build maps of the environment, characterize your environment, and then negotiate those environments. So there is a, you know, just pick the problems that you like and start working on that. And I can convince you that when the robot becomes small and lightweight, it means you really get influenced by the environment. This problem becomes more and more important if you want to build reliable underwater robots.
Yeah.
And the other road ahead, then you can imagine, is to really go fast to commercialization. You can develop things forever, and you always, scientists are good at finding problems, right? So really good at finding problems.
That's half of the role of being a scientist,
exactly,
I guess, finding the problem.
Exactly, but businessmen are good at solving those problems instead. So they don't need problems, they need
solutions
instead. And then you can start thinking that with the technology you have already, are there any problems you could solve already? And Now, suppose you have these mechanisms at work, well, quite reliably, in laboratory conditions. Of course, everybody who's working in the field or in business starts laughing when you say working reliably in laboratory conditions.
Yeah, we're talking about technology readiness levels.
But still, you have a technology that is reliable, cheap, and small. So what could you do with underwater technology like that? And with a conventional underwater vehicle, there are many places you can't go because they're very expensive. They're very big, which makes them rather clumsy. So you don't go to very shallow waters because they're just too big to go to very shallow waters. And you didn't go to places where you probably are not able to get it back from because they are terribly expensive. And if you think of underwater robots that you can send on like places like a surf zone on beaches or rivers and ponds and lakes and places like that. So if you think it's non-important, no, it's the other way around. This is the places where most of human activity is taking place. And we can still leave the big oceans to these beautiful big underwater vehicles. We're never able to get like several kilometers depths under the surface, but these vehicles are. But we clearly have abundance, for example, if we want to make two civilians in a harbor or rescue people, victims, or go inside the shipwrecks, maneuver between the rocks, in the middle of the rocks, or any kind of missions of environmental monitoring also fall into this class of activities that often are beyond the reach of the conventional technology at the moment. There are also two other advantages that are associated of being compliant and made of silicon and having this fin propulsion. One is that you're awfully quiet. You don't do any noise. You don't make any noise. And then you can have other application areas such as reconnaissance or surveillance, but also also wildlife monitoring. Probably animals are not scared of something that doesn't make terrible noise. And another advantage with a fin propeller is that it doesn't beat up dust or mud or silt from the seabed. And maybe people don't realize it who live like at the Mediterranean Sea so much, but if you live here at the Baltic Sea, the whole Baltic Sea, the seabed of the Baltic Sea is covered with a thick layer of silt, of sediments, which are very, very volatile. So as soon as you go down there and you switch on your propeller, you won't see anything for a long time. It takes like 14 minutes, 15 minutes until the whole thing is settling down again and you're able to see something. So all these people who have to do pentic surveys for some reason can't actually do it with the conventional robots available right now. And fin propeller technology is one way of also getting close into these application areas. We're getting there slowly. We started a new project. The fish robot was first developed in PhiLOSA project, which stands for fish locomotion and sensing. As a project, it's a 7 framework project in European Union. And it stands, as the idea of the project is to really to build the first fish that senses flow and reacts to flow patterns. But the new projects we are getting in now is more application oriented now. It's targeted to enterprises and to commercialization and to underwater archaeology. So we are trying to adjust this technology to enter shipwrecks, archaeological sites, little shipwrecks. And if you talk to divers, underwater archaeologists who really do the field works, and you understand how difficult this problem is to divers. So shipwrecks are often very dangerous to penetrate for one or the other reason. Sometimes the places are too small, you just can't get in there. And if you can't get in there, you maybe can't get out. And mentioning the problems that you have 20 fishes and 10 are coming back and you're not still over budgeted after that. Well, in Baltic Sea and also in other places, people have gone fishing for centuries and centuries and centuries, and basically the whole seabed is covered with fishing nets. And if you get stuck in there, if you speak to divers who had an unfortunate occasion to get stuck in fishing nets. That's a very scary experience, and it's better to have your robot to get trapped there. And I mean, if 2 or 3 out of 10 are coming back, you still get yourself an impression what's inside the shipwreck.
When we talked about the fins, I would just like to clarify, we're talking about the tail fin and we're talking about propulsion. Could you say anything about the pectoral fins and the other fins and talk about three-dimensional motion, more like a reef fish rather than the salmon you use here? Do you have any input on that?
Well, we're slowly getting to investigate. Actually, biologists themselves are a little unsure about what exactly is the role of the pectoral fins in swimming in one or the other occasion. Definitely the tail fin is used for propulsions. Pectoral fins are used for stability and maneuvering. And definitely when you're working in 3Ds and you can have additional control surfaces to select like rudders, make your either surface and go down or change your angle or of attack or different things. And there are plenty of things that you can do. But if you have independently actuated pectoral fins, then you can have a more complicated mechanics. When you have a more complicated mechanics, you have a more expensive equipment. So in order to find, again, I think when we're going to the shipwreck penetration idea or whatever, we are going to exactly face the same problem. What is the most simple way to realize your embodiment so that you can still fulfill your task? But the whole thing that you're building is not coming overly complicated and overly expensive.
I understand that the fish have a large amount of sensors in this lateral line, but you've worked on using fewer sensors to get the same result. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we first wanted to have like a full lateral line of hundreds and hundreds of sensors, and we have good research partners in Italy and Lecce Nanotechnology Laboratory who are working with MEMS lateral line sensors. But as long as we didn't have them in the beginning of the project and we had to fiddle around with our little sensors, our own sensors, so we re-engineered from commercial diver watch sensors to give us a pressure signal around the flow.
And now we're talking only about the pressure, not the flow.
Yeah, you can. Fish has two kinds of lateral line sensors. Ones that are sitting inside little canals, and these are pressure sensors. And the other little hair cells that are sitting on the surface, and these are flow sensors. So fish combine these pressure and flow information together and probably gets a very, very vivid and interesting and rich hydrodynamic image about the surrounding. Now the question is that do we need all the sensors that the fish has? The fish has like hundreds of neuromasts and maybe we can cope with 10 only. Well, it's exactly, it's again the problem, what do we actually want to do? For example, we recently had an experiment in the RAV where we tried to mimic fish rheotaxis. Rheotaxis is a navigation against the flow. We all know phototaxis. Phototaxis is something that our children do when they play with their Lego Maestro robots. They have this little light-sensitive diodes, and then you have a light source and you have to go towards it. So this is called a phototaxis. Many insects and other animals have the same reflex. And fish have a similar reflex called the rheotaxis. So lots of fish, it's very widespread among fish when they are exposed to a uniform flow, since they keep themselves aligned against the flow, their nose into the flow. A problem for various reasons, because from flows there comes food, oxygen and information, and you need all of them. So it's just sitting there and seeing if you open your mouth, is there anything useful that comes?
A smell source.
And a smell source too. Smell is information.
Yeah.
So, and we had two pressure sensors on both sides, and we tried to do the same little experiments that you do with your Lego Mindstorm robots to make it understand where the flow is coming from. And quite reliably, we could hold the same fish aligned against the uniform flow for a pretty long time, just sitting there and waiting what happens.
using only five sensors instead of the fish having...
Using only two, actually. Yeah, it's only a, you know, the classical, what is called a Breitenberg vehicle, mm-hmm. where you have just two sensors and then you're doing a little, basically no memory, no elaborate algorithms between the sensing and the actuation part. So at least what it shows you is that some of the very basic mechanisms that fish are exhibiting could be fairly simple in the end. And then you might ask that why does the sen need this very elaborate lateral line? Well, fish do all sort of things and they live in all sort of very complicated environments. Maybe a robotic fish doesn't. And maybe it's a very basic of all these behaviors, that is a flow information and actuation coupling, are not that complicated after all, and there are easier ways to mimic them.
So this was very interesting. Thank you for being part of it.
Thank you.
Professor Kruzma is also the R&D Director of FITS.me Biorobotics, working alongside Chief Operating Officer Diana Sava. They've created a virtual fitting room which enables users to virtually try on clothes before buying with the help of shape-shifting robotic mannequins, which can grow from slim to muscular in just a few moments, allowing buyers to enter their measurements and see what clothes would look like on them. Professor Kruzma and Diana Sava spoke to Pear about the FITS.me idea.
We're here talking to FITS.me about their size-fitting mannequin for clothing. Could you tell me about the practical process, both for the retailer and for me as a customer that comes in? How does it go?
So, for example, if you're visiting this online store, Zegna, you go to a product page. There's a shirt, and you're American. You don't know anything about Italian brand sizing. So you see this button here, fitting room. Then you click on this button and you enter the fitting room. So there's basically two easy steps. First, you enter your measurements. We only ask a couple of the measurements and it's stored there. So next time when the customer comes in, they don't have to enter the measurements, whatever garment they're looking at. And after they have entered the measurements, let's say, then they see themselves basically. So the tool is the robotic mannequin, so it's pre-digital photos, which these are the photos that we've done before. So we show the person their mimicked body, and then they can try on different sizes of the garments on their body and choose the best garment fit. So we say the style and fit for them.
So what this has basically been is that you've done an endless array of mannequins, but you've done them by adapting one of them. You have one mannequin and it becomes endless variations based on these measurements from every unique customer.
So there's a robot army, actually, because we have several ones to cover the whole world.
We
take one garment, we do 2,000 photos. So with this, we cover 95% of the world, almost the world, different body shapes. So there's pluses and minuses. There.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk to Maria about the technical aspects of these, but we're going to stay a bit with selling such a high, such a complicated system to an industry that might not be used to this as they were before you started. What challenges and what thing did you do right or wrong when you marketed it?
First, we talked a lot about the robots because it for us as engineers and technology geeks, it seemed like a fantastic thing. But then we noticed by working with the retailers that they don't like the robot so much, meaning that it's too a little bit robust for them if you're talking about a very luxury brand or even clothing brands. Plus also we had four steps in the fitting room. So for the user, it was also hard. They basically saw the video of the robot and we got a lot of mixed messages. So the people asked, like, why is the robot there and why are you showing me this picture with this guy later? And so it was lots of confusing messages. So what we did, we actually cut out the robot because it's a tool and we don't show the robot.
You use it, you don't show it, huh?
Yes. So this is what we've learned through the processes.
Yeah. And how do you feel that selling this service now? Because it's very tailor-made. I mean, you as you said, you make 2,000 photos And this is even now, it's for, I mean, I guess you do most, what the retailer does, it they send you their garments, right?
It's actually a very easy process. For a mono brand, we can put it up in 4 to 6 weeks, but this is the maximum time. It's not the labor hours we're counting, it's more getting agreements. So all the process is run in parallel. The photograph is done in parallel, then the graphics is signed off in parallel, and also the integration, which is lightweight, is done in parallel. So everything is done in 4 to 6 weeks. The photograph itself, we don't do a photo of every garment in every size. What we do, this is the interesting part, we select fit blocks, meaning like for every brand, like Land's End, they have certain number of fit blocks. And this, let's say, 15 to 20. And these fit blocks represent up to like one fit block can represent 2,000, 3,000 SKUs, top keeping units. So if we map the brand, we only need to select 15 or even less garments to photograph. And then we show this sample garment.
Ah, okay, okay.
Some of the retailers might ask, but the end user wants to see the real garment. But there's actually, that actually we have solved with copywriting, and we actually show the real garment photo where they came from the product page on the right side. Plus also for the retailer, it's cost effective to have all their garments photographed because the seasons change so quickly. Their stock is sold out and all this. That's why we pick the generic garments.
Ah, okay.
And also the efficiency.
Because how the shirt yes. fits mm-hmm. is it's unaffected mm-hmm. by the pattern.
Exactly.
It's just the cut or the fabric.
The sizing dimensions yeah, and the fabric.
Yeah.
The main reason why people don't buy online is because they don't know if this size fits on them. Because there's too many different brands. There's also vanity sizing and all these different kind of problems.
It might even be easier to see how the cloth like folds over your body on certain material rather than on the actual material you're going to use in the dress.
And that's why we have a garment specialist and we work with their garment specialist. We make these suggestions. We usually choose more plain colors so that it's more, if you zoom in, you can see how it actually drapes around the body. Does it have wrinkles? And where does it have wrinkles and does it actually fit? So, and plus also we have so-called competitors in our field who do more mix and match services. We mean like you should wear this blouse with this kind of pants. And we're not focused on that yet. But in future, this might be one of our fields as well.
Have you had any feedback from the end customer on how the actual result have been? I mean, when they saw the mannequin fit the product, and then they came home and wore it. Is there a good match between the appearance on the mannequin and the appearance on the customer as they used it?
Yes, we have very positive feedback. We have run service. We also called the end users. And the return rates have dropped down. For example, one client at 2.99%. So it's... the returns have gone down.
And you also worked with funding this company of
yes.
Could you tell me how you what level did you start the funding work and where how has it been as a?
So after we got the funding from Estonian Development Fund, which was first funding was 2009 May, there most of the money we put into R&D, and then we developed the mannequins further. As first, we only had the generic prototypes and also started to develop the female mannequin and then market it in European market. And then as we saw that running out of money, as a lot of money was gone for R&D.
Making so, the robots work, basically.
Yes, plus also we felt that we need more smart money, meaning experienced VC funds who come in with a strong team. So that's where I started to basically raise this round that was closed now in last summer.
From the robots aspect of this, was it hard? Did they focus on the robot or did they focus on the pictures and stuff like that as the fashion brands do?
The investment fund.
Yeah,
they were
yeah.
more focused what could be the revenues. And the forecast of the revenues and how much clients would we have by this quarter of this year and all that. And also they actually see the need of this product, plus also the robotic mannequin itself, there's also different aspects, different industries we can use this as well. For example, the other part is the manufacturing side. A lot of retailers actually thought that we're selling the robots. So, and they are interested in that, because what happens is they would want a robot in each of their factories to also test their quality assurance, and also for design departments as well, having a robot that could take everybody's shape. So this would be something that they're also interested in. And this is the second focus. Now we're focused on selling this online solution, but as we grow, we can actually start manufacturing the robots and selling them to the brands as well.
So that was really interesting. If there is any would-be roboticist out there that wants to start a company and that would then look for funding, is there anything you would advise them to avoid doing that you did, that you cost you time, or any good tips you might, this we did this and it was really successful?
I think starting a robotics company, they should take at least 4 years of R&D development time, plus they would need brilliant scientists. And scientists have to work together with marketing people. So it's actually amazing how we found Maria, who actually, she's a scientist that is a marketing person at the same time. So she knows business side as well.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk a little bit about the hardware and also the algorithms behind FitMe. What you're trying to do is to allow a customer to see how a garment would fit their body type and do that from as few measurements as possible. You only input two measurements, as I say, as I understand it right now. How could you take something as complex as the human body? I guess you also choose gender and stuff. Maybe that's on top of those two measurements. How did that work, and how do you do the robot physically?
Well, so that's a basic problem, that you have 7 billion people in the world, and they all look slightly different, right? And if you have one robot and you want the robot to mimic all the 7 billion shapes, you're doomed. So you have to do something. First of all, what we did, we split the genders. We had one series of mannequins for males and the other one for women. And then we made a smart decision to start with a man, because obviously man is much simpler to do. And as a justification, we got Bible, because God also made first man, and then he, you know, reversed it and reverse engineered it, got a more complicated one.
Did that also turn out to be the right choice? I guess women are more concerned when buying clothing.
Actually, that's a good point, because women buy about twice as many clothes as men do.
They even buy them for men. So.
They even buy them for men. So from a sales point of view, it's definitely more profitable to go and sell for women, right? But we were too worried that we are not able to make the female first, because it's too complicated. Not just because a female body is more complicated, but also because the variety of clothes that women are wearing are so much different from men. What do you wear? You basically have one t-shirt or number of t-shirts, and you have some, maybe a formal wear. You have a shirt and you have a suit, and then you have a polo or something, and that's basically all you're wearing. But if you look at the variety of clothes that women are wearing, that's just outrageous, right? And then also, when they really are good, and good looking, since they for some reason like to show it off, and since they have definitely very, very tightly fitting clothes, which makes it very, very hard to actually mimic the body really in all details. And we got too scared away of starting with a woman. So from business point of view, it would have been a perfect choice. But
you also need to deliver a product. Huh?
We also need to deliver a product. And looking back, I think it was a really smart decision, because given all the trouble we've had sorting out the technical problems with the failed mannequins, so it was definitely the right choice. And then we splitted all the males into three robots. So you could say that we had a robot for S and M size, and we had another robot for L size, and then we had a robot for super big sizes. Because one thing a robot don't do is they don't adjust the height. It's still the same height all the time. And if you're now looking at the bodies, how they change, I will take a very, very small man and take a huge big man. they have very different proportions, totally different proportions. And to mimic all these different proportions is really, really difficult. So when we made these decisions and we still had to simplify more, see what is really needed and what is not needed. And then we had lots of interviews with different end customers. We talked to fashion designers, we talked to garment designers, we talked to tailors, we talked to even shop assistants and all sort of people. What actually people pay attention to, or what makes a clothes fit, and what people think makes a clothes fit. And since there are certain regions that are really, really important, for example, if you're buying a suit, it's very important how it sits on your shoulders. If your shoulders are a little leaning in the other ways, and you get wrinkled in wrong places and doesn't really fit. And at the same time, for example, the lower part of your stomach doesn't make any sense to model, because nobody will see how it's, you know, it's just the cloth falls away and this is all. And it also kind of gives a rationale what parts of the body have to be mimicked more precisely and what less precisely. And then we started with a mechanical design then, which probably wasn't very much sophisticated in a way that we didn't have a lot of modeling work. Just, you know, we should have a few actuators here and there and change this and then that. But we did kind of an agile development round. That the first prototype we did was not working too well, so we took it to the tailors. They said, So we came back, we changed the positions of the actuators, started all over and over and over again, until we got something that was finally was pretty usable. And then again, coming back to your question finally, how do we get all these different body shapes? And that's actually a big modeling problem. So I've been basically working on the modeling of the different body shapes. Even if you have the whole variety, statisticians always have ways of clustering the variety, of finding classes. That this is class A, B, D, C body shape or something. We had a research partner in Human Solutions, a company in Germany, which is a world-leading expert in anthropomorphic fashion measurements. So we used their data as a database. They have scanned like 30,000 people and to make a statistic and analysis of what kind of people are out there, how do they look like. And we came up with sort of a partitioning of the body shapes, that with this 2,000 body shapes we have, we can cover about 80% of all the customers we probably are going to have, or even more in the internet, more than 80% of the customers, but 80% of the population, I would say. You have to be a very, very special shape of the body in order that our mannequin is not able to show you how you look like.
No. So this was for the male mannequin then. Have you also started to do a female mannequin, or is that something?
Yes, a female mannequin is now up and running, and we're using it already to fit on garment. So definitely things that we still have to work with, that we are working for the feedback of the customers, what they like and what they don't like with this clothes, but it's basically there. It's a little bit more sophisticated as a male. Well, obviously it has breasts, and then he has a lot of attention you have to pay to the waist and hip ratio, because it's also kind of a region of the body that female have different from men on one hand, but on the other hand they like to show it off that it's different. So it's from a point of view how your garment fits, it's really important that you can model it precisely, and it is becoming more complicated.
Yeah. You also said that they have tight fitting and they have thin clothing, women. If somebody wears a very thin and stretchy garment, the voids between the different plates that allow it to change its shape, it's going to be shown very, very, very clearly. Do you use different technology to smooth the female mannequin out, or?
Yeah, we have the cover of the mannequin is one of the biggest R&D problems we have, where the mechanical engineers are working, is how to make these voids between the plates as invisible as possible. But it's also, we are using different mannequins for different sizes, like super big women don't have the same mannequin and very small and slim women have, so this saves us a little bit. And there is another thing that makes our task a little bit easier, is that I don't know whether you noticed, but people who are really big don't like so much very tight-fitting clothes. It's rather more people who are slim like to show, see how slim I am. And this is, if it was the other way around, we had a huge problem, because people who are of a larger size, of a great size, are very hard to model. But since they don't like that tight-looking things, it's just maybe what you want to get from the mannequin is that how are my proportions if I'm wearing this sort of a dress? And the mannequin is good enough to show it to her.
So that's really interesting. What kind of technical challenges did you have developing it? Was it the actual robot? Was it hard to develop hardware-based or...?
Definitely we had technical challenges in absolutely every phase of the development. So the mechanical crew had big problems, as I mentioned, with the cover already, then with the actuators, then we had the reliability of the actuators. If you have something like 60 linear actuators working back and forth for a long time, then you have problem with their reliability. And we had problem with middleware, we had problem with all sort of mechanical problems in the first place. But once you're doing it for a while already, then your experience just grows and grows, and now the mechanical crew is pretty smoothly handling the things already. And from the modeling point of view, again, you have this mathematical model of a human body, and it's like, how do we get it? We get it from a laser scan, from a laser body scan, and it's 30,000 laser scan points. And from a mathematical point of view, you end up with a solution space where you have 60 actuators and 30,000 points. So, you know, you have to solve a really difficult combinatorics problem, and to understand what points are relevant, what are not relevant, and how to model in the best way. So it's becoming like combinatorics problem in the end of the day. How do you find best model of the mannequin representing a certain body shape? How small is smallest error between the desired and the actual shape of the mannequin? So I would say that we had problems in absolutely every phase of development. You just mentioned the phase of development, and I would say yes, we had problems there.
and also, I guess the what we're saying is bridging the fashion that isn't really quantifiable. The I like this and this looks good, with then the high mathematics you need to do on the database to kind of translate the language between the two worlds must have been a challenge too, huh?
For me, it wasn't a challenge. I spent enough time to talk to salespeople and talk to fashion designers, and I kind of started in a very early phase to understand what they need already, and it's definitely different from what I want to offer. But with end users, when you give them the mannequins, and the hardest problem was for me was to make a difference between the features that are really, really important, absolutely crucial to have, and from features which are nice to have. Mm-hmm. For example, I had a feedback from one customer who said that I would actually also like a mannequin that had legs and had high heels on. So when I go shopping, I like to have two types of shoes to see how do I look when I have high heels and when I'm not on high heels. And I was saying, oh my God, what I'm going to do now. And then I just ignore that.
Mm-hmm. Because it's simply a small enough piece of the market that you can't address it now.
Yeah, but it's very hard to figure out by yourself what is a crucial thing and what is not. You have to go out there and ask what people want, not to try to figure it out yourself.
Mm-hmm. This is also leads to a question. As I understand, you're now a torso. You don't work with the legs and anything like that. Do you see that now when you have the torso up and running, is doing a whole human body, is it going to be twice as hard because it's twice the size, or is the legs and the lower part easier?
We didn't do legs in the first place because all the interviews, the discussions I had with different people told me that legs are not that important, that legs don't do anything but get narrower in the end, so it doesn't really matter how the things fall. Now we're also getting a little different feedback. Some people say the ties are important because they show how your trousers are going to fall. Well, it's still a cost-benefit analysis where we have to do here, is that how much does it take to develop those legs, and how much added value does the customer get from seeing itself with the legs? I would say it's also different from different types of garments. Suppose you're wearing a very, very tight-looking dress or a miniskirt. That's probably how your legs look like is extremely important. But if you have, like, suppose you have a wide, long wedding dress, it's completely invisible how you look under that, so it doesn't matter. And it's, again, something that sales and marketing people should figure out how important it actually is, and then there is a business decision to take.
There was also mentioned the fact that the industry wants to use the mannequin in their own communication to improve their business process. Have you seen that there is a difference between the robot you use to sell people clothing on the internet and then this robot used in the process of developing the garment in the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. But we're pretty ready for that because the story goes that before we came out with the online retail application, we were thinking about tailoring application. So we have a tailor that has a mannequin and you don't have to go to fitting, so the tailor can put them on. And we still think it's a very good business case and we're going to work it in the future. But it just happened so that online retails was promising us more revenues in shorter times, online tailoring. But since we started this use case of tailoring, then we already figured out what is really important from a garment design point of view on a human. And these are measurements, for example, that you cannot enter to the internet. For example, the slope of your shoulders. How do you measure the slope of your shoulders? But the tailor can figure it out. And the way you hold your legs when they're just hanging down there, what kind of angle do you have it? It's really, really important when you're wearing, for example, a suit, because you're going to have wrinkles in one or the other place, depending how.
Now we're talking real customization here.
Real customization. And now when it comes to big fashion designers, what is important for them is that their clothes fits as many people as possible. And then I can imagine that when you're designing your new model, you can try it on completely different body shapes. See, for example, if I have a customer with the same pressed crease, but with a different slope of shoulders, am I still able to sell all of these items or not? And here where you can, without trying it out in hardware, in a hard way, first manufacturing and then seeing what is left unsold, instead of having few prototypes and trying them in your office and different prototypes and seeing what is likely to fit to a great variety of different customers.
Yeah, interesting, very interesting. Thank you very much.
And that's all for today. As always, you'll find more information on RobotFish and Fitz.me on our website at robotspodcast.com. The next episode will be available on 15th of June. Until then, goodbye. Enterprise with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.